Heichel Menachem presents A Tale of Two Souls, an ongoing lecture series on the Tanya by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchok Jacobson. This is tape number 30 in the series, entitled The Two Souls Declare War, recorded live at Heichel Menachem, Brooklyn, New York.
Good morning. Tanya Perek Tess. The ninth chapter of Tanya, page 26, Afid Gimel Amud Beis, the last line, Achinek Siv. In the beginning of this chapter, Rabbi Shneir Zalman of Liadi, the Alter Rebbe, explained the difference between the two souls, the two states of consciousness that exist within every single Jew and their place within the body. The vital, natural soul that exists in the Jew resides and dwells in the heart and the left ventricle. The divine, transcendental, godly soul abides, it dwells in the mind of man. And the difference, as we have explained at length in the previous class, is that the animalistic, vital, natural soul is primarily impulsive. Its activities, its behavior, its instincts, its convictions, and desires are based on impulse. Even the intellectual, cognitive experiences of the animalistic soul are ultimately a result and a consequence of its heart, of its impulses. The rationale, which is used and often used, and sometimes in a very professional fashion, is ultimately a result, a consequence, an outgrowth of the impulsive instinct of life and ego that characterizes the essence of the vital natural soul. The divine transcendental soul in man, on the other hand, is connected to the Jew's mind, awareness, understanding. Because what characterizes the nature of the divine soul and what dictates its behavior and its desires is a vision. Not of what I want at this moment or what I dislike or what I don't want at this moment. Not what satisfies me today or what doesn't satisfy me today. It's what is true in life. What is reality in life? What is worth living for? What is the purpose of life? At the core of the divine soul is a vision, is a destiny of what's true. This is what dictates every aspect of its life, including its emotional attributes, its emotional faculties, which are all guided and directed and are created, crafted, and molded as a result of a vision, of an understanding of what is true, of destiny. Now, the Alter Rebbe continues to discuss the perpetual battle of these two souls in man's life. Let's look inside. Achi neksiv. However, what is the however? The however is, as long as these two souls would have been confined to their respective locations in man's body, and not one interfering with the other's character and desires, man would be at peace with himself, with his environment, and with the world. Ah, however, he says, however, it's written in Torah in the beginning of Parshas Teildas, he makes it, la'ayim la'ayim yamatz. The might shall pass from one regime to the other. And this is, of course, the pasuk describing the nature of the conflict between Rivka and Yitzchak's two sons, Yaakov and Esau. The Torah in the beginning of Parshas tells us the story, how Rivka conceived after many years of an inability to conceive. But Vayisreitzetzu Abanim Bekirba, the children that she carried in her room agitated within her, something which perturbed and bothered Rivka very deeply, to the extent that she said, Lama za'anechi, what am I needed for if this is the case? Vatelech Lidrishes Hashem. She went to inquire by the prophet, by Hashem's prophet, what is going on over here. And Hashem communicated to her that Shnei Goyim Bevitnech. There are two nations in your womb, Ushnei Le'umim Mimei'ayich Yeparedu. Two regimes shall separate from your inside. Ula'ayim Mila'ayim Yamatz. The might shall pass from one regime to another regime. And sure enough, she gave birth not to one child, but to two children, Esav and then Yaakov, which grew up to represent and to father two distinct nations, Yaakov, the Jewish nation, and Esav, the Roman, ultimately the Edomite, which resulted in the Roman nation. Two lives, two philosophies, two convictions, two purposes, two visions, two distinct destinies that most of the time were at war and at conflict with each other. The spiritual, every story in Torah has its physical explanation, its concrete manifestation, but every story, indeed every word, has also a spiritual conceptual counterpart. So the story of the conflict of Yaakov and Esav in the womb of their mother, and the following struggle between them all along their entire life, which is related in the following portions, is not only a physical story about two distinct people who lived several thousands of years ago named Jacob and Esau, Yaakov and Esav, but it's rather a spiritual, conceptual truism that mirrors and reflects two spiritual dynamics that exist in all of our lives. Each and every single one of us carries the torch of Yaakov and the torch of Esav. And the whole story about these two brothers and their ups and downs and trials and tribulations and all the details exist and are mirrored and reflected in our personal lives. Chassidus explains that Yaakov represents the divine soul in man, the divine state of consciousness. Esav represents the natural, vital, animalistic state of consciousness. Rivka carries two children within her womb, but she's deeply upset. She is grieved. She says, "Lama zeh anochi? Why am I alive?" So she goes to communicate with the prophet, and the prophet says, "Don't worry about it. There are two regimes in your womb." And Rivka is suddenly at ease. Why is she suddenly at ease? What changed? Did the pains become any lighter, any easier? What is the difference? What was this revelation that the prophet communicated to Rivka that suddenly put her heart on ease? Put her to ease. What was the change? The pain was still there. The spiritual, in light of the spiritual story, which occurs at those moments, we understand this very clearly as explained in the Tanya. Man feels constantly, day by day, sometimes hour by hour, sometimes moment by moment, a pull in two opposite directions. There is a major duality that characterizes his life. One moment, man may feel a yearning to transcend the earthly parameters and to touch the divine. At that moment, man is taken over by a sense of ecstasy, passion, and longing to connect his life, to link his personality, his character, with something harmonious, absolute, eternal, and true. And at that moment, everything mundane, immoral, animalistic, selfish, suddenly dissipate and are worthless, are meaningless, are naught, are nothing. Man at that moment makes a conviction to live a life which is moral, which is holy, which is good, which is godly, constructive, purposeful. But then an hour passes, or a day passes, or sometimes a week passes, and that passion is gone. And suddenly, man sees himself as a very simple, animalistic, self-indulgent person whose primary interest in life is self. Satiating the ego, self-preservation, self-orientation, totally self-indulgence, without any deeper vision or destiny. And everyone experiences it. So at one moment you're so godly and spiritual, at the other moment the very basic animalistic instincts take you over, and you gravitate toward certain behavioral activities, or certain lusts, or certain desires that are totally inconsistent with a true vision and a spiritual purpose and destiny in life. And at that moment, when you think about your previous state, it's worthless, it's meaningless. Just as when you were involved in the spiritual, the other side was meaningless. Now that becomes meaningless. Who cares about visions or destinies or what's true, what's not true? This is what I want at this moment. This is what my body so desires. And then the question arises, with its full might and power, Lama ze anechi? Who am I? What am I? Who is man? Is man basically, after everything said and done, an animal only capable of celestial illusions, dreams, or fantasies? Yes, an intelligent animal. Hence, he can conceive of all types of interesting transcendental dreams and fantasies. But essentially, man is a selfish, egotistical creature, period. Or is man perhaps, as the Torah describes him, someone who's created in Hashem's image, someone whose purpose and inner character is to project and reflect something of the harmony and the truth of his Creator? So the question comes to man, who am I? What is real? Is the spiritual, godly experience truly real? It does not seem so. The question is not only due to the polarity of experiences. It's that when man is taken over by the animalistic experience, that seems to totally overwhelm him and shut out any other vision or perspective. And it's not just a philosophical question. It's an emotional question. If ultimately I am an animal, so why the work? Why the toil? Isn't this just one big fiasco? Ultimately, we are who we are, and everything just evolves around that animalistic creature and his fantasies. So Hashem answers Rivka and responds, no, you're making a mistake. Shnei goyim bevitnech. There are two nations in your womb. Ushnei lo'umim imeayich yiparedu. And two regimes shall separate from your insides. Ula'oim ilayim yemot, and might passes from one regime to another. One nation shall prevail over the other nation. As long as man makes the mistake that there is one soul existing within him, yes, indeed, the question of who is man and what is his ultimate destiny comes to us in its full strength and crushing power. Comes the Al Reb Shnei Zalman, the Al Terebbe, and explains to us, Shnei Goyim Bevitnech. There is an essential duality and multiplicity inherent in the very psyche, nature, and character of man. The Jew is not a one-souled creature, he's a two-souled creature. There are two personalities, two complete souls. Every soul consisting of the entire range of will, intellect, emotions, instincts, desires that make for a functioning persona. It's not just two electrical forces in man. It's two complete souls, two personalities, two human beings, each one with its own philosophy, mindset, convictions, vision, behavior that exist within man. The Nefesh HaLikis on one hand, and the Nefesh HaBahamas on the other hand. And both are very true. Neither of them is an illusion, a dream, a fantasy, or a fake, or fiasco. Both are true forces that exist within the human being. Hence, the trials and tribulations, the ups and the downs, the opposing desires that characterize man, the two opposite forces that we live by. On one hand, our yearning towards the divine and the spiritual. On the other hand, our deep desire to take care of ourselves and only of ourselves. It's a perpetual struggle between selfishness and selflessness, between egotism and transcendence. Or, to paraphrase the famous line, to be or not to be, the two souls also have that perpetual struggle, to be or to be not. The animal, natural soul, vital soul, begins with an instinct of I am here and I'm here to stay, to be. The divine soul, its character begins with a vision of what is true in life. And what is true in life is one truth. Godliness, Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch. So it gravitates with all of its faculties to be nullified in the all-pervading truth of real reality, of true reality. So this is the meaning of Elohim Elohim Yematz. The might shall pass from one regime to the other. That there are two regimes, two governments, two perspectives, two souls, two complete lives in every single man. So the fact that man, at times, yes, has a true longing to connect to the divine, and then is suddenly taken over by sometimes an immoral lust, that does not demonstrate that his spiritual longing was false, was a fantasy, was a dream. By no means. The divine soul in you is very, very true. However, there is also another soul. There is also another state of consciousness. And this perpetual struggle and battle between the two souls is what Alter Rebbe will now describe. Yeah.
Spirituality.
You think someone who grows up apparently in a spiritual environment.
Not even, let's say, a Yiddish environment.
Just a Yiddish environment, not necessarily a spiritual environment. One of the plagues of Judaism in this century is that Yiddishkeit has become divorced from inner meaning and spirituality. It often becomes robotic and machine-like without any deeper meaning or passion. So that was a valid distinction. You know, in the early 40s, the tshuva movement was not popular, to put it mildly. The direction of American Jewry was the other way. But there was one American boy who has become a Baal tshuva. He returned to Yiddishkeit and he started to observe the mitzvahs on a day-to-day basis. So his mother came running to the rabbi of the shul that she belonged to, and she said, "Rabbi, I know you for a smart man. You must help me. My son became a sugar. He simply went crazy, lost his mind." So the rabbi says, "What happened?" She says, "He started to put on the black phylacteries every day. Totally nuts." So the rabbi says, "Okay, what else did he start doing?" "He started to eat certain foods, yeah, not other foods, kosher foods." She says, "Yeah, you're brilliant. How do you know?" "Yeah, that's even worse. He comes into my house and he only eats these other things." Then the rabbi says, "Mr. Probably he started to put on tzitzis, these white fringes hanging out of his pants." She says, "Your mom is a prophet. How do you know how crazy my son is?" So he says, "I know, I'll tell you I know. I do the same thing. I do all the same things." And he says, "You're coming to me. It doesn't seem that you think I'm crazy. So why do you think your son is crazy?" She says, "There's a big difference. You do it for a living." So your question is, how is it that someone can grow up in a Yiddish environment and totally not experience any spiritual or godly longing? If every single person has this animal soul, this godly soul, how is it, in other words, that a person can grow up for years, and you mean initially have it and then lose it?
They don't necessarily have the perpetual struggle either.
It means there's no struggle. The animalistic soul has its say all of the time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Well, that's a very good question, but I don't think there can be one answer to describe all cases. Every human being, every Jew possesses both souls at all times. However, man can silence the divine soul. Man does have the ability to subdue it and to crush it, never to eradicate it. Huh? There's choice, yeah. Never to eradicate it. As much as one tries to totally eradicate from within himself his inner voice, the inner divine consciousness, that man cannot do. That is part of who he or she is. But what man can do is, when the person never thinks about his godly soul, never learns about it, never nourishes it, never allows it to express itself, it's like any talent that a child may have if he's never given the mediums to express it. If he's never given the information and the knowledge about that talent he has, that talent could remain within him, buried in the subconscious cellar of his character, and never be expressed. So what can happen often is, by so much self-indulgence, based on the character and personality and lust of the animalistic soul, man desensitizes himself. His immune system, the spiritual, psychological immune system, becomes very weak. And he doesn't hear anymore the voice of the divine soul, you see, because the divine soul speaks and sings another type of melody of the animalistic soul. Usually the melody of the animalistic soul is very concrete, very materialistic, very coarse. Usually. Sometimes it can be very poetic and deceivingly spiritual. The divine soul is very subtle. It's fine by nature. It's spiritual, it's transcendental. But sometimes we become so indulged in the here and the now, in the materialistic husk, that we do not allow ourselves to listen to a deeper melody that continuously sings within us and strives to be expressed. Heisenberg was a famous physicist who lived in the 30s. And he's known as one of the people who have explained to the world and revealed to the world the concept of quantum mechanics, modern physics. And he had some colleagues, scientists and physicists, who were scoffing from him. And said that there's no such an existence, because quantum mechanics discusses the level of subatomic particles and uncertainty principles that in the sciences and the physics, as it was known until then, it was totally absurd. So in response to some of the people that were constantly arguing with him, he gave an example of a fisherman. There was once a fisherman who decided that he's going to make a talk. He's going to come to discover once and for all exactly how many and what type of species exist under the sea, under the water, and what is their size. So the anecdote goes that he built a net, a large, infinite net, spread it, that can spread all over the seven seas, and one Monday he lowered down the net into all the waters of the entire earth, left it there for a few days, and then raised the net. And he had, of course, millions and millions, endless of species of fish and all water creatures. The following day he came out with a declaration to the world. And what was the declaration? That there is no fish existing in our universe that is smaller than 1 inch long. And what was the problem, of course? What was the problem? That the holes in the net were 1 inch. So the holes in the net were 1 inch. So he decided that there's no fish that are smaller than 1 inch. The instrument through which he attempted to capture his fish was not a valid instrument to capture fish that are smaller than 1 inch. The instrument to listen to our divine soul to our transcendental state of consciousness are not the same instruments through which we listen to our animalistic song. There is a certain sensitivity required. There is a certain refinement, a certain sublimity that man has to experience and learn how to use and learn to come in contact with in order that he or she should be able to listen to the beautiful, exquisite music of the Nefesh HaLakis. Yeah. If God made us with two souls, how could we be blamed for anything? You can always blame it on one of the souls, so what's the problem? What, you want to answer the question? Would anyone like to?
Sure. The blind man and the can't walk.
Oh, yeah. So what do you do with the understanding of Barashi Yitzhar, Barashi at the top of it?
The answer, of course, is that man does have two souls, but as we will see at the conclusion of this Perek, is not doomed. Man is not doomed. These two souls create a challenge, an opportunity, not an experience that does not give the person any choice. Man does have the choice and the ability that despite and in the midst of this struggle, he can continuously tap in and access his divine soul and make it the dominant factor in his life. A. B. Furthermore, man has the ability to refine and educate the animalistic soul. Because as we shall see soon, the natural vital soul, and I keep on exchanging the words from animalistic, vital, natural, and someone asks me, why do I keep doing it? In Tanya, he calls it Nefesh HaBahamis, animal soul. Nefesh HaChiyunis, vital soul. Nefesh HaTivis, natural soul. Why does he give it all these names? Because this denotes, each one of these names denotes another facet of its persona and character, which are very important. The animal soul is not evil, in essence. It's not evil incarnate that has to be crushed, eradicated, subdued, nullified, abnegated, destroyed, burnt, and destroyed eternally. It's not evil inherently. It's just a vital, natural, animalistic soul. An animal is not evil, God forbid. It's a creation by Hashem. The animal soul is just that aspect that puts us in the category of the zoological species. Intelligent species. Extremely intelligent. But it just makes us part of the zoological species where life is for the sake of life. I am, I exist. At the core of that soul is the sense of self, the sense of ego. And life is for the sake of life. It wants to enjoy itself, it wants to be comfortable. It wants to be happy. Whatever makes it happy, that is what it gravitates to. Now, when you come into a physical world, the soul is enclosed in a body. What, at the surface, what is reality in our world? What looks good in our world? Naturally, at the most basic level, without contemplation, without meditation. Physicality. Materialism. So that's why the animalistic soul gravitates towards that. Sometimes it's a more sophisticated soul, so it gravitates to more sophisticated things in our world. It's just like the difference between a child and an adult. We discussed two weeks ago. A child could walk around eating garbage, eating things from the floor. An adult would not do it. An adult already lost towards other things. Why is that? Is there an essential difference over here? No. It's just the maturity of the child tells him that this is the best thing in life. The sense of maturity of an adult allows him to lust for deeper things. So the animalistic soul is not essentially lust for garbage. It is a drive and a force which wants to exist, which wants to satisfy itself. But naturally, what is good? What is existence all about? On the most basic level, it's physicality, it's mundane things, it's sometimes immoral things. And over here is the challenge of man, that not only he could vanquish and subdue his animalistic soul, ultimately his responsibility is to educate it, to refine it, to talk to it, to communicate to it. not just this basic animal that exists in man, which is blind and totally divorced from any vision. It can be refined. It can be directed. In the state of the true mystic, defined in Tanya as the tzaddik, it can totally be transformed to the extent where it becomes an equal partner with the divine soul. But that's the ultimate state of the true mystic. But the animalistic soul, in all sense cases, can be sublimated and can be educated and refined. When someone transgresses, when someone does an aver, does the godly soul take a hike? Huh? The Nefesh HaBahamas certainly has mastered man at that moment, and has mastered his behavior. His behavior now, his organs of the body, have become an instrument to express the animalistic soul, which is discussed in this perek, actually. However, that is the conviction, the desire of the animal soul. However, this is an interesting difference between the divine soul and the animal soul. The animal soul can be sublimated. It could become a partner to the godly soul. The godly soul can never be eradicated. In other words, man can ask the following question. I want to live like an animal. I'm happy with my animal soul. So you say, very good, but you're going to have a difficult time because you're never going to be able to be happy like that. What if someone comes and says, Ich will sein a Behemah? You know the story with the Yeshiva Bacher? Last month passed away in Yerushalayim, Reb Shalom Shvadron. Reb Shalom Shvadron was a famous Bal Musar, known as one of the most famous Magidim in this generation. Preachers who would discuss religious ethics in a unique style and Jerusalem type of melody. I once heard from Reb Shalom Shvadron the following episode. He says, a yeshiva bacher, he said it in Yiddish in a unique melody. So in English, it's a little bit difficult to convey the entire message, but I hope you'll get the point. He says, a yeshiva bacher once came over to me complaining. What was his complaint? His complaint is that he has such a bitter life. It would be so much better if he would be able to live the life of an animal. He says, look at a cow, a dog, a cat in the street. They don't have to eat with a fork. They don't have to eat with a knife. They don't have to dress up every time they want to go out to the street. They don't have to do certain needs of their body in exclusive, isolated places. They could do whatever they want, wherever they want, whenever they want, however they want. And the yeshiva bacher became so involved in what he was saying that he actually began weeping. And he said, Master of the universe, Ribbono Shel Olam, why didn't you make me a behemah? Why did you have to make me a human being? Why do I have to suffer all my life and live a life constricted and inhibited based on certain norms and morals and set of values? What do I need this for? And he said in Yiddish, in the melody, why didn't you make me an animal? And Reb Shalom turned to him, I'll say it first in Yiddish, and he said, Bacher, Bacher, du hast nicht was zu weinen, du bist a behemah. Bacher, Bacher, you have nothing to cry. You are indeed a behemah. That's who you are. So what if a person comes and says, very nice, there are two souls, there are two states of consciousness. But I would like, I'm comfortable with my Nefesh HaBahamas persona. That's it. It's perfectly fine. I don't need anything else. So the response to such a person would be, you are ultimately being untrue to yourself, to your real self, and a person cannot achieve real wholesomeness, tranquility, and happiness if he only nourishes his animalistic soul. For a day you might be happy, for a week, for a month, for a year, for a few years. But we are who we are. The human being has embedded within him a divine transcendental state of consciousness that he cannot eradicate. So man says, but it's still unfair. Because if I live based on my godly soul, I will not be happy because of my animal soul. If I live based to express my animal soul, I won't be happy because of my godly soul. So where's the deal? Anyway, I won't be happy. So I would rather express my animalistic soul and that way not be happy. As they say, the modern day anecdote, they say today that, you know, they discover that all types of food kill you. Whatever you eat is unhealthy. So basically, you have to starve. I would rather die from eating than die from starvation. So he says he would rather be unhappy being a vehicle and an instrument for his animal soul than being unhappy being a vehicle and instrument for the divine soul. But over here is the major difference. If one dedicates his life to become a chariot, an expression for his animal soul, he will never be able to pull down his divine soul and make it animalistic. It will always remain as is. Even in the midst of an avera, the godly soul gets schlepped down. True. Because both souls are one unit and every act incorporates both souls. There's no such a thing of doing one act divorced from one of the souls. But ultimately, when it gets schlepped down, it remains loyal. It remains within its transcendental spiritual oasis. Even as it's schlepped down into a pit of mud. So whatever man does, that inner voice, that inner consciousness, that inner connection always remains. What about the other way? It doesn't work the other way. When man serves and makes his life an expression of the godly soul, ultimately, the animalistic soul, in its true essence, will follow. And as it learns to appreciate what true good is and what true reality is, it will become refined and it will be sublimated. And ultimately, it can become a true colleague and a true partner to the godly soul. And man's challenge is, ultimately, to create some type of harmony and union between these two souls. But this harmony can only be done through one direction. If you follow your animal soul, you'll never create harmony. Because the godly soul wants truth. The only way we could create harmony is if man connects and touches and comes in contact with the deeper element of self, which is the truer element of self, and then ultimately, slowly but surely, demonstrates to the animalistic soul how this is what you should truly appreciate and desire. Okay, let's learn a little bit inside. The first line on the top, Daf Yudalet Amud Aleph. Ki haguf nikra ir ktana. The body is called a small city. This is a metaphor in Kehelas, Perek Tes, Pasuk Yudalet, explained in Masechta Nedarim, Daf Lamed Beis Amud Beis. Our body, each and every single one of our bodies, is defined as a small little city. The problem is, it's a city that has two kings that are trying to conquer it. If it would just be a city left alone, with one ruler, Shalom, Amachaya, peace. Problem is, you have one little territory, Sachakal, a little body. It's a reminder, it's like the Middle East. You have one little piece of territory. And millions of people all want that same piece of territory. So you have one little body, but there are two kings that are both trying to dominate that body. They want the body should belong to them. Just as two kings who wage war over a city. Which each one of the kings wishes to capture and to rule the city. What does it mean to rule the city? Dahainu, that is to say, lahani geshvakuritsaina, to direct its inhabitants according to his will. Vishayiyu sardim lamashma asai, so that they obey him b'chol asher yigzer aleihem, in all that he decrees upon them. That is what it means to capture and to rule a city. It's not just that your army, your legions are stationed in all the strategic places of the city, or at all the portals or gates of the city. It means that the inhabitants of the city live their life according to your will, according to your dictate. They obey the king in all that he decrees upon them. So this very scenario of a city that has two kings, and both kings are constantly, their entire life, waging a war one against another over this city, each one trying to capture, rule, and dominate the city. This is the exact metaphor of what occurs every moment. Every hour, every day, every month, every year of our life on the face of this earth. Ultimately, all man's problems, all man's depressions, the struggle in man, whatever it may be, in whatever way it may express itself, can be boiled down and can be traced back to the root and the core of all of it. And that is the two kings that are constantly, continuously, day by day, fighting over the same territory, which is man's body. Kach shtei hanefashos. So too, the two souls. What are the two souls? The first soul is halekis, the divine soul. V'achiyunis habahamis shemei aklipa. And the vitalizing animal soul, which originates from klipa, from the shell, from the husk of reality, and is therefore the very antithesis of the divine soul, because the divine soul deals with the essence of life, with the essence of reality. The animalistic soul originates from which realm? From the shell husk, from the shell realm, from the realm of a husk which conceals and obscures the truth. So when you have two souls coming from these two different realities, they have two mindsets, two philosophies, two convictions, two destinies. So these two souls, that's why the Alter Rebbe emphasizes Shemei HaKlipa. It's not just a natural soul, it comes from Klipa reality. So its agenda is a different agenda. So these two souls, Nilchama Zuim Zuala Guvachale Vardov, they wage war against each other over what is the war? Over the body and all of its organs. Here too, each soul wishes to direct the city's inhabitants according to his will. So the body is analogous to the city. The organs of the body are analogous to the inhabitants of the city. Each one of the two souls, which are mirrored and reflect in the kings, want to capture the city, which is the body, and that all its inhabitants, all its limbs and organs, should live and behave day to day based on the desires and dictates of these souls. So first he begins describing what is the agenda, what is the battle plan, what is the vision, the perspective, the desire of the divine soul. And that is what he continues to discuss throughout most of this chapter. And following that, he concludes what is the battle plan of the other soul of the animalistic soul. So this is what he begins saying now. Shahalikis, the divine soul, Chefter Itzayna, her will and desire is Shatehi Levada Hamishalos Olava Manigas, that she alone rule over the person and direct him. V'chol Heivarim Yusarim L'mashmas, so that all the organs of the body be subject to her discipline, Uptelim Eilel Agamri, and that they surrender themselves completely to her. Umerkava Eilel, and she desires that all the organs shall become a chariot for her. A chariot is the metaphor that they become a vehicle, which its sole identity and function is to express the will and the desire of the one who rides that chariot, who uses that chariot. So the divine soul wants that the body and all of the aspects of the body shall become a medium, an expression, and a chariot for the persona, the convictions, and this character of the Nefesh HaLikis. What? Why do I say she on the divine soul? Because Nefesh and Neshama is Lashon Nekeva. It's feminine. That's why I use the word term she. Yeah. V'yiyu levush, and the divine soul desires that the organs of the body be also a garment, an instrument of expression. La'eser p'chinaisaha v'gimol levushah haniskarim le'el. For her 10 faculties and her three garments mentioned above in chapters 3 and 4. Sheyislapshu kulam be'ivari haguf. That they should all enclose themselves within the limbs of the body. The divine soul, as explained in the previous chapters at length, its personality is comprised of 10 major traits and attributes, 10 faculties, and 3 garments through which it expresses its personality. The 3 garments are thought, speech, and action, which in the case of the divine soul, it's thought, speech, and action connected to Torah and mitzvahs. So the divine soul wants that the body should be the medium of expression, the garment, the instrument, where the entire persona of the divine soul with all its 10 faculties and all its 3 garments are enclosed. So the body becomes an abode, a house, a dwelling place for every aspect of the character of the divine soul. V'yiyah ha'guf kulei mali mehem levadam. This is a serious battle plan. The divine soul wants that the entire body should be permeated with them alone.